Good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. Oh, I gotta turn the mic on. Okay, now welcome everybody. This is Bio 231, November 18th, and we're gonna move on to the next chapter. This is the second chapter that we're covering for the final exam. The first one is heart, so don't forget about heart. And maybe I'll talk a little bit about heart today anyway, because there's some things you got to know about it for a review. Okay, let's look at the schedule first. Schedule is first. So we said today's the 18th. Indeed, it's the first period after that lecture. And we are going to cover blood vessels and... we don't have to get through it all because we've got lymphatic system next time, and lymphatic system is a really short chapter. And we'll probably jump ahead a little bit and get into respiratory system next time. All right, so when is your next test? Your next test is December 9th. Unless you're a Monday lab, you have a practicum on December 7th. All right, so you have that practicum, fourth practicum on 7, and you can find out what's involved with that just by looking at the syllabus. All right, and December 9th is a Wednesday, and so the Wednesday labs are scheduled to have a lecture exam and a practicum on the same day, one lab before the exam and the other lab after. And so what I would like to do is offer to people that are in Wednesday section an opportunity to take the practicum with a Monday group. And I've done that before previously, and very few people have elected to take their practicum early, even though they kind of let them end up with the lecture exam and practicum on the same day because it's early. But if you can plan your schedule ahead of time, you might wish to take advantage of that. Okay. The other thing I noticed was that the Monday labs this week got nothing done because the lab before the lecture exam, you're studying for the lecture exam, and then the lab after the exam, you just were really fatigued and really didn't do very much. And since the Wednesday group is going to be missing that review session, I'm going to open up the lab so that no matter what lab you're in, you can go in and work with materials in lab. Okay, so I'll hold regular class for the regular people, but if you want to walk into lab and see what we're doing as far as dissection or look at some of the models, you're welcome to do that. All right, so I'm most concerned about the Wednesday class because they're missing that additional time. All right, so especially you people with the Wednesday lab, you might want to come in on a Monday sometime, either 8 a.m. or 12:35. Okay, does anybody like that idea? Nobody. Okay, well, that's an opportunity for you. Any question on the schedule? No? Okay. I'll put the schedule away. And, oh, look what we got right here. I said, here's a very important diagram. I'm sure it is an exam figure. It shows the circulatory system, right? And we're pretty much done talking about the heart, and we're going to get talking about these blood vessels right here. And this is a really nice diagram because it shows some basic vascular architecture. And here I see the aorta. What's the function? This is all aorta that I'm hovering over. What's the function of the aorta? Okay, what's the function of the aorta? We got to get this down. Somebody take a guess. Look at this arrow right here. It takes blood away from the heart. That's right. That's what the function of this aorta is, because it's a systemic artery, right? So the function of any artery is to take blood away from the heart. All right, and then it gets into this capillary network. And these are actually microscopically small blood vessels, just barely big enough for a red blood cell to squeeze through there. And what's the function of a capillary? Exchange. It's neither to take blood away from the heart or bring blood back to the heart. It's got a different function, and that is exchange. These capillary walls are so small that material can actually move across them. And then here is a vein. What's the function of a vein? Brings blood back to the heart, right? Okay, so you notice that there are red arteries and blue arteries, and that's because there are two circulations, right? There's a pulmonary and systemic circulation. The systemic arteries are high in oxygen. The pulmonary arteries are low in oxygen. That's why they're going to the lungs. And what's special about the lungs that allows this blood to pick up oxygen? Exchange? Yeah, but what about the structure? What kind of structure, since this is anatomy class? What structure does the lung have that allows for exchange? It has capillaries. That's what I was after. It has capillaries, right? So that's the kind of blood vessel that allows for exchange. And then here is a vein, right? Because you told me veins bring blood back to the heart, but it's red, and that makes sense because it picked up oxygen in the lungs and it's bringing it back to the heart. So when you think, when you compare pulmonary circulation with the systemic circulation, you should think of them as being opposite to each other, right? The systemic artery is high in oxygen. The pulmonary artery is low in oxygen. So if we're going to look at a lung and we see a blue blood vessel in a lung, what can you tell me about that blood vessel? Name that blood vessel if it's blue. It's a pulmonary artery, right? Because arteries in the pulmonary circuit are low in oxygen and then exchange takes place. All right, so how many capillary beds do you see? Just for the systemic circulation. I see one artery, I see one vein, and one capillary bed, just one network. So this is a typical kind of circulation where you have an artery that brings blood into this capillary, and then the blood returns to the heart. Only one capillary bed, right? I don't see two. Otherwise, we'd have to draw in another capillary over here someplace or over here someplace. All right, then, and I don't see that. All right, so does anybody have a question on this very nice review slide? I don't want to go over the anatomy, but all the important anatomy of the heart is right here, too. All right, so that's a really good slide. All right, so let's get started with chapter 20, General Features of Blood Vessels. And we're going to be interested in layers once again. And notice that the overall layout of this slide pretty much is like the previous one I showed you, where you have an artery and a vein, and what do you have in between those two? You have one capillary bed, and I see one capillary bed right here. All right, so what's different about this is that we now have done some microsurgery, and we're looking at layers of blood vessels, and that's what we have right here. All these blood vessels, except for capillaries, have three different layers. And the outermost one is called the tunica externa. And that contains collagen fiber. So it's a strong sheath that holds everything together. And it helps anchor these blood vessels to surrounding connective tissue. And notice that the externa for an artery, okay, is about the same shape as the externa for a vein. All right, they're basically about the same. Okay, so then the inner layer, tunica media. It has smooth muscle and it has elastic fibers. Smooth muscle to prevent it from ripping when there's high blood pressure, and elastic fibers so that these arteries can expand, and as the pressure decreases, then these arteries go back down to their original diameter. Right? So these are these two layers that are in the tunica media, and notice that veins don't have these elastic fibers. Okay? They have some muscle, but they don't have elastic fibers. What muscle does is that these are circular smooth muscles. When it contracts, it occludes or contracts the diameter of a blood vessel, and that reduces its flow. Right? So arteries can do that, and veins can do that as well. It's an important regulatory mechanism for blood pressure. Veins do not have to have elastic tissue because they never experience high blood pressure. That's going to expand them. It's always very, very low blood pressure. All right, then, the innermost layer. And let's start with by far the innermost layer. Right? We call this the endothelium. And I see endothelium over here in a vein as well. And what do we call something? What kind of tissue lines a cavity? An epithelium. Yeah, so what kind of epithelium does this look like to you? Simple, because I just see one layer. And it's squamous, right? So it's a simple squamous epithelium, and it's smooth and slippery so that blood can flow over the endothelium without generating blood clots in a nice healthy blood vessel anyway. All right, the thing that I notice with the endothelium, there's a big difference between arteries and veins, is that veins have valves in them. Right, so here is a flap. When blood moves in the direction toward the top in this particular blood vessel, these valves open up. When it tries to go back down, then the valves touch each other, and it prevents that retrograde flow of blood, if it's a healthy vein. If the vein is dilated, right, then these valves are not long enough to touch each other, so when there are pressure changes in this vein, blood will just go back and forth, and not be returned to the heart, and that can generate blood clots, which can go to the lungs and cause pulmonary embolism, and that's actually very dangerous and can be fatal pathology. All right, so veins have valves to make sure that blood goes only back to the heart, not back down to the periphery. All right, that leads us to the structure between an artery and a vein, and it is the capillary bed. And if we look at a capillary bed, I see that it only has endothelium, just a simple squamous epithelium. And that is why exchange can take place in a capillary, because these walls are very thin. Material can move across this wall, but the walls of a vein and an artery are way too thick. Nothing can move from the blood to tissue spaces or tissue spaces back into the blood, because this wall of the artery, wall of the vein is just too thick. Not so for a capillary. All right, so again, when you have an artery taking blood away from the heart and a vein bringing blood back to the heart, what do you have in the middle? A capillary bed. And how many capillary beds? What do you see right here? I just see one capillary bed, right? And I see it red colored at the proximal end and kind of blue colored at the distal end. And so you should be able to tell me what kind of capillary is that. What circulation does it belong to? Systemic or pulmonary circulation? Okay, and maybe you could even just look at the color of this artery right here. So what circulation has red or high oxygen in arteries? Is a systemic, that's right. So here, right, this is a systemic artery. Here's a systemic vein because it's blue, and you can actually see the oxygen leaving this particular capillary, right, because it slowly turns from red to blue in this area. All right, so capillaries are there for exchange because they just have a simple squamous endothelium. All right. Any questions on that? So you do have to know some of these layers for sure. Okay, here's another pretty good slide. I see an artery that's red and a vein that's blue. So we're thinking, what kind of circulation here? Systemic circulation. All right, and this arterial blood is high in oxygen. This particular artery is so small that you really can't see it with your naked eye. It's something that we call an arteriole. And an arteriole, right, just branches out, and that's what delivers blood to a capillary network, right? And then here's a vein. How many capillary networks do you see between this artery or this arteriole and this little tiny vein called a venule? I just see one capillary bed. Okay? When I look at this, all right, I also see some circular smooth muscle. Here and here and here, we call these the precapillary sphincters. Precapillary because they guard the entrance to the capillary bed, and then they regulate blood flow through these capillaries. We don't have enough blood in our body to go everywhere at one time, and our body has to choose where it goes. Like if you're an exercising muscle, then of course you get blood at the expense of some other places in your body, right? If you're not exercising and digesting food, guess where blood goes? Yeah, to your gastrointestinal tract. And if you try to do both at the same time, it doesn't work very well because there's just not enough blood. All right, so here is that feeder branch. Okay, and sometimes we call this a meta-arteriole. And if you trace it through, you can see that it goes directly to this venule. It will bypass the capillary bed. That's the job of the meta-arteriole. But as soon as this tissue needs oxygen, then these precapillary sphincters relax, and then blood flows through these capillaries, and then what happens? Oxygen leaves, CO2 goes in, and maybe some other metabolites go in there as well. Okay, and this bottom sequence over here, right, the precapillary sphincters are contracted. So tell me something about this tissue. Let's just say this is a muscle tissue that this capillary bed is embedded in. What can you tell me about this muscle right here? Look at blood just going right through this meta-arterial into the venule, not going through the capillary bed. So what could you tell me about this muscle? I don't see it here, but I know it's in there. What is it doing? It is relaxed, right? If it started to exercise and oxygen go down and produce some other kinds of compounds, like ATP would go down, ADP would increase, then these precapillary sphincters would relax and then blood would flow through that exercising muscle, bringing nutrients like glucose, oxygen, and getting rid of CO2. These precapillary sphincters are not under control of the nervous system. They're under what we call local control. Local control just means whatever kind of metabolites are in the interstitial fluid around this capillary controls how these precapillary sphincters behave. Right, so if there's high CO2, if there's lactic acid, if there's high ADP, that's going to cause these sphincters to relax. Right, if there's high ATP and high oxygen, then these sphincters contract so that blood just goes through this meta-arterial and doesn't waste time in this capillary bed. All right, so one more time. From an artery to a vein in this particular picture, how many capillary beds do you see this blood going through? Just one. Yeah, so that's a typical circulation. Even on that first slide that we looked at, you have an artery, capillary, vein. That's a typical kind of circulation. All right. Well, what makes an artery? Takes blood away from the heart, right? And it could be oxygenated or deoxygenated blood. Give me the name of an artery that has low oxygen, an artery with low oxygen. Pulmonary artery. Nice, nice, nice. Arteries have high pressure. That's why they have those elastic layers and stronger, much stronger, smooth muscle layers. Right? So the elastic layer, especially in large arteries like the aorta, they can expand a lot. So any artery near the heart can bulge a lot, but with those elastic fibers, then it goes back down to its normal diameter very easy. So we call these conducting arteries that can stretch and then go back to its normal size. Medium and small arteries are called distributing arteries. They do have a muscle layer that can contract, right? So they can vasodilate when the muscle contracts, vasoconstrict when those muscles contract. And it is the sympathetic nervous system that controls contracture of those muscles. So if there's an increase in sympathetic tone or activity, that causes vasoconstriction. And you might be wondering, why is that so important? Well, let's think about a balloon. If you have a balloon and grab it and start to squeeze it, what happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Does it change? Does it go up, go down? I heard both. All right, so we got to agree. We squeeze a balloon, the pressure goes up, right? The pressure goes up. And if you press too hard, the pressure is going to get high enough to do what? To explode that balloon, okay? So when these muscle layers contract, cause vasoconstriction, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up, right? That's one way of maintaining blood pressure, via vasoconstriction. Okay, so that's one thing that's important. Another thing that's important besides blood pressure is blood flow through a particular vessel. Like here we see these capillaries, there's no blood flow. These capillaries, there is flow. And there is one important parameter that determines how much blood will flow through a blood vessel or a tube, any kind of tube. And you don't have to know the name of this principle, but when you change the diameter of a blood vessel, then the amount of flow through that blood vessel changes by the fourth power. So that's huge, right? So if it changes, right? So if we have radius of a blood vessel and look at flow, measure flow, and we just give these numbers 1 and 1. Let's double the radius from 1 to 2. What happens to blood flow? Does it go to 2? No, it goes to 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, which is 16. So what you should be aware of is that small changes in the diameter of a blood vessel cause huge changes in the amount of blood that can flow through that particular blood vessel. So if we were to dilate a blood vessel 5 times, change the radius by a factor of 5, look what would happen to blood flow through that tissue. 625 times, because it's what? 5 times 5 times 5 times 5. And that's how your body regulates where blood flows, is by vasoconstriction or vasodilation, and that obeys the fourth power rule for blood flow. All right, arterioles. They can vasodilate, vasoconstrict, sometimes under local control. So if it's local control, what's affecting the diameter of that particular vessel, that arteriole? What is causing vasodilation or vasoconstriction if it's local control? Okay. It's just the metabolites in that area where that blood vessel is. Right? So if there is low oxygen, that blood vessel is going to vasodilate. If there's high oxygen, right, it's going to vasoconstrict because that tissue doesn't need a lot of blood. It's already right where it should be in terms of oxygen. So arterioles are controlled by local control, but also by sympathetic tone. And what I mean by that is sympathetic nerve activity. As sympathetic nerve activity increases, there's vasoconstriction. And when there's vasoconstriction, what happens to blood pressure? Yeah, it goes up, right? Take that balloon and press on it. Okay, so those are some arterioles. That precapillary sphincter controls blood flow into that capillary bed, like we see right here. And that happens only under local control. There are no nerves that go to the precapillary sphincter. So if this tissue is in need of oxygen, right, then these precapillary sphincters dilate and blood flows through, bringing in oxygen to this particular tissue. All right, and that can only happen, right, exchange only in a capillary. But you know what? There are different kinds of capillaries. Let me see if I can find some of these different kinds of capillaries. And they're different by how leaky they are. Oh, I was right there. Okay, so here's the first kind. I see a nice simple squamous endothelium that lines this particular capillary, right? So we know it's a capillary. There is a little bit of connective tissue that surrounds that. Right? And I see some very small intercellular clefts. Right? So these endothelial cells are not joined tightly together, but there are spaces between them. And can this red blood cell move out through this space into tissues? If you look at this illustration right here, can this red blood cell get out of this capillary? It can't because it's too big, right? But what about a small water molecule or a glucose molecule, which is small? Then yes, it can leave. Or what about a molecule of oxygen or something? It can fit through these spaces very nice. This is why exchange can take place in a capillary. This kind of capillary is called a continuous capillary. It's not very leaky compared to some others that we're going to look at. Okay, like a fenestrated capillary. Here's a fenestrated capillary, so I can actually see, right, some pores, which we call fenestrations in the endothelium. So not only are there intercellular clefts, and in this case it even looks a little bit wider compared to continuous capillaries, but there are additional holes where material can move back and forth, but these are tiny holes, so a red blood cell can't move through, right? But fluid can, and other metabolites can pretty easily. All right, so this is the kind of capillary that we would see, for instance, in a kidney. And we're going to look at a kidney in a couple weeks. And we'll see some special properties of these fenestrated capillaries. And then there's one more. All right, now tell me what you see here. Does this look like the most leaky or like an intermediate kind or not leaky at all? Most leaky. Yeah, look at all these holes right here. Look at these large intercellular clefts. It almost looks like this red blood cell can sneak out right here, but it's not quite, this hole is not quite large enough to do that. These red blood cells are still trapped inside the capillary. Right? But the fenestrations are large, right? The intercellular clefts are large, and this is what we call a sinusoidal capillary. These are very leaky. Some places in your body, like liver, filter blood as it passes through. Blood actually leaves the cardiovascular system, flows around cells in the liver, and then it's put back into the cardiovascular system. All right, so you got these three kinds of capillaries, right? You got continuous, fenestrated, and sinusoidal, and they are listed in order of permeability or leakiness. meaning that the continuous kind of capillary is the least leaky of all of these right here. All right, but some of these capillaries are more leaky than others, but what do they all have in common? What's the purpose of a capillary? Exchange, right? Through the fenestrations, intracellular clots, and because these endothelial cells are small, or thin, that's a better way of thinking about it. All right, so if we look at a real-world capillary, here's a real-world capillary, right? I see the endothelium here and here, and guess what's inside this capillary? Red blood cells, right? And these red blood cells can only get through this capillary one at a time, and they can just barely sneak through. But that's okay because that allows for oxygen that red blood cells are carrying to move only a very short distance from the red blood cell through the capillary into tissues, which is what the job of a capillary is, right? It's kind of fun to see that, all those cells lined up like that. Okay, so capillary, then blood returns to the heart, right, via a venule. That's just a small vein. And then small veins join together to form veins. And what's the function of a vein? Bring blood back to the heart. That's what a vein does. Artery takes blood away. It doesn't matter if it's oxygenated or deoxygenated, right? It could be either one. Veins have the lowest blood pressure. The high blood pressure is in arteries, and that's why walls of veins are not as thick and strong, because there's very low blood pressure in them. Now, the way that blood moves is by experiencing a difference in blood pressure. Blood will always flow from high pressure to low pressure. All right, so if that is the case, that explains why arteries have high pressure and veins have low pressure, and that's going to force blood into veins because the pressure in veins is so low. And that's where the lowest blood pressure is, as a matter of fact. All right, don't forget, veins have something special. There's a special thing that is developed by the endothelium in veins that we don't see in arteries. But we do see it in the heart. These things are made from the valves, the endocardium, right? The endocardium in a heart makes the valves. The endothelium in a vein makes the valves in a vein. Okay. And there's no muscle associated with them. It just, they move by pressure changes. All right, so if veins have low pressure, and the heart has low pressure, and blood will only flow from high to low, how does blood get back to the heart? That's sort of an interesting question, because there's not a lot of pressure. Well, there are a couple pumps that help blood return to the heart. There's something called a skeletal muscle pump and something called the respiratory pump. And let's see what kind of slides I have for that. I just have the skeletal muscle pump. All right, so when I look at this blood vessel right here, it's blue. Does that mean it's a vein or an artery? It could be what? Could be either, depending on whether it's pulmonary circulation or systemic circulation, right? Doesn't matter. But I know this is a vein. How can I tell this is a vein? Because I see valves, right? So only veins have valves, no arteries. All right, so here are a couple muscles. When they're relaxed, they don't bulge out. They're nice and linear and straight. And this compartment over here is relatively large, but when these muscles contract, they compress this compartment of this vein, right? And as it squeezes down on the vein, what happens to pressure in this segment of the vein? It goes up, all right? So it's going to squirt down to the periphery, or it's going to squirt up back toward the heart. And can you tell me which way is it going to go? Is it going to go both ways? Will it go retrograde or antegrade only? Forward or backward only? It's only going to go forward because the valves prevent the backward flow of blood, or what we call retrograde flow. And that only happens, of course, if this is a nice healthy vein, right? That is small enough in diameter so that these little flaps actually touch each other. If this vein dilates to where they don't touch each other, then blood is just going to flip-flop back and forth. So this is the skeletal muscle pump, right? So when skeletal muscles contract, it forces blood back to the heart. And that's a really good thing, because if blood is stationary and not moving, I think I've mentioned this before, what happens to blood when it sits still? It forms a clot, it forms a solid, right? Because it's a connective tissue, it forms a solid, and then that can cause blood clots in lungs and heart, brain, and other kinds of places. All right, so this is the skeletal muscle pump. I don't have a picture for the respiratory pump, but remember I said that fluid flows. How does fluid flow? From, according to pressure, from high pressure to low pressure. And a gas is a fluid and a liquid is a fluid. All right, so all fluids behave just that way. So how does a gas enter our thorax? What has to happen to the thorax in order for air to enter it? Right, the pressure in the air is going to stay the same. So what has to happen to pressure inside your thorax in order for air to flow in? It's got to decrease, right? It's got to be lower than atmospheric pressure. And the way we do that is by expanding our chest, right? By contracting our diaphragm and some other muscles of our thoracic cage. That expands the volume, the pressure decreases, air flows in. But not only air flows into the thorax, right? Your thorax is a vacuum cleaner. It's going to suck in air, but it's also going to help suck in blood, right? Because those veins near the heart are in the thoracic cavity. And so when you inhale, that also helps return blood back to the heart. So exercising muscle helps return blood back to the heart, and even just breathing does, the respiratory pump. And it's always a good idea if you're sedentary for a long period of time, right, to get up and exercise just a little bit, walk around. Maybe some of you are going to get on an airplane and travel to Denpasar, Indonesia. You know, it's a 14-hour flight. And it's probably not a good thing to sit in that chair the whole time, because there are cases when somebody experiences a pulmonary embolism because the skeletal muscle pumps aren't working, blood was stationary in a vein, and it formed a clot. Okay. And that actually happens fairly often. All right, so that is, how does blood get back to the heart? All right, pulmonary circulation. All right, so here is nice heart. And I see some lungs over here. What's the most anterior great vessel coming off the base of the heart? And when I say great vessel, I mean big one. And I see it right here. It is the pulmonary trunk. And that's probably something that you should just memorize, right? Because if you know that the pulmonary trunk or pulmonary artery is the most anterior, then you know that there's one behind it, which is the aorta. And since these are both arteries, when you look at one during dissection, they look the same. They both have thick walls, and they look exactly the same. And you're going to know this is the pulmonary because as you move from anterior to posterior, this is the one you run into first. All right, so here's the pulmonary. Behind the pulmonary is the aorta. Behind the aorta is another vessel, and that is the superior vena cava. It's really easy to tell the inferior vena cava because it's thin and floppy. It doesn't look like an artery at all. All right, but pulmonary and aorta can be confusing. All right, so we're going to jump into this lung over here. And I'm going to pick out a blood vessel like this one right here. You see where the cursor ended up? Is it big enough for you to see it? That blood vessel right there. Tell me the name of this blood vessel. It's a pulmonary. I like that. And somebody yell it out loud. It's a pulmonary artery. That's right. Because an artery takes blood away from the heart into the lungs if it's a pulmonary artery where it can pick up oxygen. All right, so blue blood vessels signify low oxygen. These are arteries in the lungs. And then they move through a special kind of blood vessel, pick up oxygen, and then it returns to the heart. All right, so what kind of blood vessel is this red one? A pulmonary vein, right? And this is opposite compared to the systemic circulation. All right, so what kind of special blood vessel is between this pulmonary artery and this pulmonary vein? What kind of blood vessel is in between? Yeah, it's got to be a capillary, right? It's got to be a capillary. And in this particular circumstance, there's only one capillary bed. So here I see a little capillary, very thin walls. Here are pockets, air pockets in our lungs. These are microscopic, and these capillaries allow CO2 to leave our body and oxygen enter. Okay, because the wall thickness is just very, very thin. All right, so I think that's all I want to say about Okay, the pulmonary circulation. Well, let's go over it one more time. Pulmonary circulation starts with the right ventricle, pulmonary trunk, then it's either going to go to the right or left pulmonary artery, right? And then it's going to go through a pulmonary capillary, and then how many pulmonary veins do you see? One, two, three, four. And you'll see that in the models in lab, and maybe not on the real hearts that we're looking at. All right, and as it comes back, where does blood go from these pulmonary veins? These four pulmonary veins are attached to the left atrium, right? And that you could consider like the origin or the beginning of the systemic circulation, right? And so then the left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta, that's the systemic artery because it is high in oxygen. Okay, anybody have a question about that? Question about that? Okay. All right, let's take a look. That looks like an exam figure or something. Okay, we're going to look at some blood vessels, starting with the aorta. And maybe I can zoom in to help see what's going on. Yeah, that's probably going to work pretty well. All right, so here are some systemic arteries. And the pulmonary trunk is not shown on this illustration, only systemic circulation. So here is the aorta, and I see a couple different divisions of the aorta. This one that is coursing from the base superiorly, we call this the ascending aorta, and it's kind of short. And then this one that curves around, nice hairpin turn, that's the aortic arch. And then as blood starts to descend or move inferiorly, then this is the descending aorta. And if I'm going to zoom out, okay, the descending aorta has two divisions. The descending aorta that is in the thoracic cavity is called the thoracic aorta. And the part of the aorta that's in the abdominal cavity, that's the abdominal division of the aorta. Okay, so could you tell me, well, how do you know that this is the abdominal cavity? Right here. Do you believe me or not believe me? Yeah, because here is the diaphragm that separates the thoracic cavity from the abdominal cavity. Okay, so let's get back to the heart. I see three branches off the arch. Right, so a branch just means that there's a blood vessel attached to some main blood vessel and it's going to carry blood away. The first one is the brachiocephalic. And brachiocephalic has two words that are put together because you see a nice O right smack in the middle of them. You have brachio. What's the brachium? That's your arm. That's right. And cephalic means toward the head. So here is an artery that's going to bring blood to the head and also to the arm. And can you figure out what side of the body this is? What side of the body does the brachiocephalic bring blood to? The right side. Yep. All right. But very early on, the brachiocephalic bifurcates, that just means splits in two, into arteries that take blood to the head and then an artery that takes blood to the arm. The one that goes to the arm goes right underneath the clavicle, so we're going to call that the subclavian artery. Right? When it gets into the armpit region, that we're going to call that the axillary artery, right? And then the brachial artery when it gets down into the arm. We'll go and look for that in just a little bit. All right, so that's the subclavian. This one that goes to the head is called the common carotid. It's a carotid artery, and it's so super important because it brings blood to the brain. We don't have many arteries that bring blood to the brain. This is one of them. And you see that we get up into this region right here, and it splits. It splits into an external branch and an internal branch. And guess where that internal branch goes? To your brain. And the external part just goes to everything outside the cranium. So that's a really important artery. Here is that junction between the internal, external, and common carotid. That's why we got to call this one the common, because there are other kinds of carotids like external and internal. Here's the junction between those three arteries, and it's kind of enlarged normally, and there are some special things in this area. There are pressure sensors, and there are chemoreceptors. There are receptors for pH and carbon dioxide and blood pressure. So this area right here has a very important role in adjusting blood pressure in our body from second to second. And because of that bulge, it makes pressure in this area go in really funny ways, and it causes damage to this area. This is what's called the carotid sinus. And it develops plaques, and if those plaques break out and get into the internal carotid, guess what happens? You get a clot in your brain in particular. What do we call a clot in your brain? A stroke. That's right. So this area right here is very prone to causing strokes in people, and this is probably the part of the body that's imaged the most anywhere, probably in the world, for sure the United States. All day long, ultrasound people, ultrasound techs are taking images of this area right here, just looking for the carotid sinus, for signs of disease. All right, I'm going to go over this again with another slide, but I see another blood vessel that's ascending, and it does go into the brain as well. So there are two arteries that go to the brain, internal carotid and this one. This one right here goes through the transverse foramina of vertebrae. And so we want to call this one the vertebral artery because it goes through all those vertebrae. Do you remember cervical vertebrae have those foramina in the transverse processes? And that was one way you could always tell cervical from any other kind. Okay. All right, so we looked at this. Oh yeah, carotid sinus. Here it is in your notes. It's important, right, because it brings blood to the brain. Let me see what else we have here. Oh, here's a better picture. All right, so here is a blood vessel that splits into the common carotid and subclavian. So this blood vessel right here has got to be a brachiocephalic, right, artery. Here is the common carotid. This area is not labeled on the slide. This is the carotid sinus, and I can see the external carotid and internal carotid. And do you see the vertebral artery? Look at right here, going through all those transverse foramina of cervical vertebrae, and it goes into the brain as well. So you only have four blood vessels that can bring blood to the brain. And so you don't want to have disease in any one of them, because then you're not going to have enough blood or oxygen going to the brain. So a lot of these things you don't have to know, but vertebral is good. Common carotid, internal, external carotid, and of course subclavian, brachiocephalic, and arch of the aorta. Let's look at the cerebral circulation just a little bit. All right, so here is the base of the brain, and I see the internal carotids. Right? So here is the right one, here's the left one that brings blood to the brain. Here are the vertebral arteries, here and here. Notice that the vertebrals anastomose, and the term anastomose means joined together, and it forms one artery. We call that the basilar artery. Right, so the vertebrals form the basilar, and then look at this thing right here. It's a circle. We used to call that the circle of Willis. Right, and so it's got a couple pieces. It's got these anterior cerebral arteries. These come from the carotids. It's got this posterior communicating artery, and it forms this circle. And so why is that beneficial to have this circle right at the base of the brain? The circle gets blood from both carotids, both vertebrals. Why is that circle really, really handy? What does it remind you of in terms of the nervous system? Does it remind you anything in terms of the nervous system? Okay. I don't see any circles, but nervous system, I saw plexus. Right? I saw a network of nerves that joined together and split apart. And I see that with these blood vessels as well. Right? And the beauty of a nerve plexus is that nerve impulses can take a number of different routes to get to important organs. So if one route is damaged and doesn't work, that organ can still function because it can get nerve impulses from some other location. The same thing for the circle of Willis. Right? It connects to all four arteries that bring blood to the brain. So if any one of these arteries is damaged or occluded, that's pretty much okay because the other three can supply blood to the whole brain as a result of that. All right, so that's the purpose of the circle of Willis. And anastomose, don't forget, means what? Joined together. All right, subclavian, we kind of looked at that already. Okay, this is pretty good. All right, so here's that subclavian that turns into the axillary, turns into the brachial, right? And then in the arm, then it just turns into the radial and ulnar arteries. What do I have on here? Yeah, that's it, ulnar and radial. So these are really easy to find in lab. And when you want to count somebody's heart rate, this is the artery that is very superficial and easy to palpate. So where would you take your pulse? Do you have a sense of where you would put your fingers to take your pulse on your wrist? Is it medial or lateral? It's lateral. Yeah, I feel mine right there, right? And what's the lateral artery in your forearm? It goes, it's named by the bone, and that's the radius. So that's the radius artery, radial artery. And so that's why sometimes we want to take a radial pulse from a patient, because it's just right there in the wrist. Nice superficial blood vessel. All right, thoracic. Yeah, let's talk about this. At first, it's going to seem kind of confusing, but it's not too bad. Let's take a look. Is this, I don't want to look at that one. We got to have a good one someplace. Maybe I just have to go back here. Okay, and then I'm going to zoom in a little bit. And we're looking at the aorta. Now, what part of the aorta is this right here? Descending. I like descending, but you could even be more specific, right? It's the abdominal division of the descending aorta. And the aorta gets a lot of disease, so a lot of times we want to be specific just like that. All right, so I see some branches coming off the aorta. And when you look at branches off the aorta in the abdominal region, there are unpaired branches and paired branches. Branches of arteries that are paired go to organs that you have, how many copies of? Two, right? Like the renal arteries going to the kidneys. You have a right and a left because you have two kidneys. Here's one that's going to go to the stomach. And so it is an unpaired branch because we only have one stomach. All right, so let's look at unpaired branches first, and there's only three. This one right here, there's one artery that comes off and splits into a couple others, bringing blood to the spleen and stomach, but I only want you to know the name of this thing right here, and that's called the celiac trunk. Celiac trunk, that's the first unpaired branch. We move down over here, I see another unpaired branch. This is going to feed blood to mesenteries, and we're going to call this the superior mesenteric artery. And since this is a superior one, you could probably guess that there is an inferior one, and here it is right here. All right, so celiac trunk, superior mesenteric, inferior mesenteric artery. These are coming off the abdominal aorta. All right, well, that just leads us to look at some paired branches. Well, we talked about the renal arteries already. Here are the adrenal glands. There are arteries that go to the adrenal glands as well, so those would be the right and left adrenal arteries. And then these two here right now are kind of mysterious, but if we were to draw in where they go, they would go down to an ovary or all the way down to a testes. And so these are the gonadal arteries, because a gonad, both an ovary and a testes, is a gonad, right? So these are the gonadal arteries. And it's kind of funny because they're really far away from gonads. They're in the abdominal cavity. All right, so that's what I want to look at there. Okay, so here is that abdominal division of the descending aorta, and it goes to here, and then it bifurcates, right? The splitting of blood vessels is a bifurcation. This is a major blood vessel, and we're going to call it common because it's going to bifurcate once again. This is the common iliac artery, and probably you see it kind of getting close to the ilium over here, so that's why we call it the iliac, common iliac. And as we move down a little bit further, I see a little branch coming off going into the pelvic cavity, and it's moving interiorly, so we call this the internal iliac. And then this one that's going to go outside to the limb, that's the external, right? So internal, external iliac. Then when we get down into the leg, here is the femoral artery. And then behind the knee is the popliteal. And oops, what else do we want to see? Okay, the tibial artery right here. You don't have to worry about that. That's not on your list. All right, but you do have to know femoral. What body region are you going to find the femoral artery? Your thigh. Popliteal is in that popliteal region, which is the posterior part of your knee. Right back over here. Okay. Veins are kind of easy because a lot of times they're just named after the artery that they course along with. All right, so here is the femoral artery. There's going to be a vein moving right through here, and that's going to be called the femoral vein. There are maybe a couple exceptions to that, and that is we don't have a carotid vein. We do have a big vein in the neck, but we don't call it carotid. We call that the jugular vein. All right, so a couple of places, it changes a little bit. But we got iliac. All right, so here is external jugular, internal jugular, and it joins the subclavian vein. All right, so here is blood returning from the head and the arm. What do we call a blood vessel that relates to both the arm and the head? Brachiocephalic. I'm going to even zoom in some more. All right, so remember that there was only one brachiocephalic artery. Because on the left side, on the arch, you have the common carotid and subclavian coming off immediately by itself. All right, but not so for veins. There are two. So here is the internal jugular. Here's the subclavian. They join together. And you should know what that term is called when blood vessels join together. It's right here. Anastomose, right, when blood vessels join together. So jugular, subclavian, anastomose to form this single vessel, and it's receiving blood from the arm and from the head. This is a brachiocephalic vein. Okay? But I want to know, for veins, I see two of them. So we got to know left and right for veins. What side of the body is this over here? The left side. So here's the left brachiocephalic vein. And over here, I see a brachiocephalic vein, but it's very short. Here's the jugular, here's the subclavian. The brachiocephalic vein on the right side is just right here. It's very short. All right, but nonetheless, it's still a lot different than the left brachiocephalic. So when you look at the vein, you got to say right or left. For the artery, you do not have to do that. Okay, some circulations. Well, here's a question. Superior vena cava, high oxygen or high CO2? Like here I see the right and left brachiocephalic veins, anastomose to make the superior vena cava. What's the condition of blood in the superior vena cava? Low in oxygen because it's part of your systemic circulation. Right. Same thing for inferior vena cava. Do we have an inferior vena cava? Ah, yeah, right here. Here's the inferior vena cava. Those will be nice landmarks when we do our fetal pig dissection. Okay, some blood vessels in the brain. And let's see what we have for blood vessels in the brain. Right here. All right, so remember, around the brain is the meninges, which is a tough membrane. It's got three divisions to it. And the dura mater is the strongest one. The dura mater has some caverns, which we call sinuses, built into it. All right, so here I see the inferior sagittal sinus that has blood returning from the brain back to the jugular. And then here is the superior sagittal sinus. And I can see some small veins getting blood from the brain, the proper brain, and moving into this large space. So the superior inferior sagittal sinus joined together to form this sigmoid sinus, which means like it's S-shaped right through here. And then they join together to form the jugular vein, as well as getting some blood from this part, which we call the cavernous sinus, which is at the base of the brain. And so the sagittal sinuses, both sagittal sinuses give blood to the jugular, but also this cavernous sinus right here. And what does cavernous mean? Just big. right? It's just big in the brain. So we call these dural venous sinuses because they're made up of the dura mater. So it's not really a blood vessel, it's just a special part of the dura mater that's there. Well, we're ready to talk about some circulations, okay? And what is a typical kind of circulation? Let's look right here. You have the heart, you have a vessel taking blood away from the heart, which is an artery. Then you have capillaries, right? As a matter of fact, how many capillaries do you have? Oh, yeah, this is what I want. Okay, so here's an artery taking blood away from the heart. Here's a capillary bed. And then after this capillary bed, all these capillaries anastomose into this vein. So I see artery, capillary bed, vein. There's one capillary bed. That's a typical circulation. In some places in our body, there is an additional capillary. And it produces a system we call a portal system. So let's take a look and find a portal system. All right, so I see an artery, I see a capillary bed, then I see a vein, and if this is a typical circulation, where is this blood going to go when it's in this vein? I don't know, can I find that slide? Can I find it? Right here. After a capillary, where does it go? Back to the heart, right? Via this vein. So a typical circulation, you have artery, capillary, vein. But what we're looking at here is artery, capillary, and a second capillary before it goes back to the heart. This is a special portal system. And this blood vessel that interconnects these two capillary beds is called a portal blood vessel. And I think you had to know. Did you have to know the I was on a test. The hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel. That was the blood vessel that connected capillaries in the hypothalamus to capillaries in the anterior pituitary. That's the first time when we looked at this portal blood system. This one right here is called the hepatic portal system. All right, so when we say hepatic, what does that refer to?
Liver.
Liver, right? So here's a special circulation in the liver. So arterial blood brings nutrients, right, oxygen to the stomach and intestine. And if you're in a fed state, then you're going to have glucose in the intestine. It's going to be absorbed by these capillaries. And as a matter of fact, anything else that you have eaten, right, is going to diffuse out of your digestive tract into the blood via these capillaries. And many things that we consume are fairly toxic to us. Right? So to prevent toxicity, this blood isn't emptied into the total circulation. It gets grouped back into this hepatic portal vein. Remember, portal is between two capillaries. And the portal vein takes it to the liver where there's another capillary. And remember, what kind of capillary was that? A fenestrated capillary, a very leaky capillary, and then blood flows around all these liver cells, and the liver cells are called hepatocytes, and these hepatocytes, part of their job is to detoxify harmful compounds. Okay, and then after the blood is detoxified, then it's returned to the hepatic vein, inferior vena cava, then back to the heart. Right, so this is a portal system. Why would you be able to tell that this is a portal system? Because I see two capillary beds back to back, right? Just like two capillary beds in the hypothalamus, number one, and then in the anterior pituitary, number two. First capillary bed, second capillary bed. So a portal system is a special door-to-door delivery system. What's ever picked up by this capillary doesn't have to go through the entire circulation. It gets delivered directly to where it wants to go, like from the hypothalamus directly into the anterior pituitary, or in this particular case, from the stomach directly into the liver for detoxification. So that's the beauty of a portal system. So the word slide right here kind of just shows us that. The gastrointestinal tract capillaries, right? That's capillary bed number one. where things are absorbed from your stomach, right? You get the superior, inferior mesenteric vein, splenic vein, right? That blood goes into the hepatic portal vein, and then the hepatic portal vein takes it into the liver, and in the liver there's the second capillary bed, right? And so that defines what the portal system is, and then after the liver it leaves via the hepatic vein, and then to the inferior vena cava, and then to the right atrium. Okay, so that's a portal. Can you picture what a portal blood system looks like? I think, I hope. Yes. Okay. All right, what is one good way to think about the systemic circulation and, or the systemic circulation and pulmonary circulation? What's the, what's one good way to think of, I don't want to say relationship, but the architecture, or what's happening in those two circulations? For instance, in the systemic, arteries have high oxygen, but in the pulmonary circuit, they have low oxygen, right? So I like to think of pulmonary circulation and systemic circulation as being opposite each other. Okay, so I just kind of make a little diagram with my hand. They're opposite each other. There is another system that is opposite, right, and which is a really good way of thinking about it. Okay, and that is the fetal circulation. So we're going to go over fetal circulation just a little bit. All right, so here are the lungs in the fetus, and a fetus just means a baby that hasn't been born yet, right? So it's in utero. So this baby is in utero. Are they using their lungs? They're not breathing, right? They don't have air to breathe. So, but they need oxygen. Where do they get oxygen from? From their mother, right? And here is a special organ that is acting like the lungs, and this is the placenta. So the placenta is where exchange takes place. And this is a really interesting organ because this is the only organ that I know of that is made from two different people to come together to make an organ. So it has fetal tissue as well as maternal tissue as well that join together. All right, so here is a blood vessel taking blood away from the heart. What has that got to be? An artery, in particular the aorta. It comes down here to the iliac, and here are a couple special blood vessels that move on either side of the urinary bladder into the umbilical cord. And if this was an artery, what can you tell me about these blood vessels here? Okay, taking blood away from the heart, these are arteries as well. If they're in the umbilical cord, we call these the umbilical arteries. Now, does the blood in this aorta and these umbilical arteries look red to you? No. Okay, so they're not high in oxygen. But that sort of makes sense, okay, because this blood is going to go to the placenta. What's going to happen in the placenta? Exchange, right? So oxygen in the placenta is going to move into this blood that's coming through the umbilical arteries, and then here's blood returning to the circulation, right, to the fetus, and it's going to take it back to the heart. So this is what, an artery or a vein? A vein, okay. So this is a fetal circulation. What circulation in the adult that you know of, okay, has red veins or veins that are high in oxygen? The pulmonary, right? So when you think of the fetal circulation, you should kind of model it in your mind as the pulmonary circulation. And as you can see, it's pretty much doing the same kind of job, right? It's oxygenating blood, the placenta is. All right, so the placenta is part of the fetal circulation, the umbilical arteries are, the umbilical vein is, and also in the fetus, the liver is not very functional either until right at birth. Okay? And so the liver function is also maintained by the mother via the placenta. So blood doesn't need to get into the liver, so blood bypasses the liver and goes right into the inferior vena cava. Right? And so this is like highly oxygenated blood. This little tube right here, right, is called the ductus venosus, right? Because it's a vein, ductus venosus. It's a vein that bypasses the liver. Blood doesn't need to go there. Okay, and then up to the heart, it gets into the right atrium, right? And then maybe into the right ventricle. Where is the right ventricle going to pump blood in the adult circulation? The right ventricle is like the origin of the pulmonary circulation, so it's going to pump it to the lungs. But should blood go to the lungs in the fetus? No, because there's no oxygen there. So it would be a waste of energy, extra work on the heart for no reason. So there is a hole between the right atrium and left atrium, and we call that the foramen ovale. What's the foramen again? It's a hole. It's a passageway for something, right? And it's oval-shaped, and it belongs there in the fetus, so blood directly goes from the right atrium into the left atrium, and when it does that, does it go through the lungs? It skips the pulmonary circulation. Right, and then when you're born, that foramen heals over. In most cases, it doesn't heal over in some people right away. There might even be somebody in here that has that foramen that is still open between their atria, and people can live a long time before it starts to have a bad effect on their heart, maybe 30 years old, maybe even up into the 40s. All right, if that foramen is open, we say that it's patent. A patent blood vessel is a blood vessel that allows blood flow to go through it. And a foramen, if blood is going through a foramen, that it is a patent foramen. So in the adult, if they have that hole that hasn't closed, or the foramen ovale that hasn't closed, we call that a patent foramen ovale, or a PFO. We just call it a PFO. Okay. Sometimes it has to be surgically repaired, sometimes not. And that's kind of interesting, because just a few years ago, in order to close that patent foramen, then that required open heart surgery, that required opening up somebody's thoracic cage, which is really major surgery, right? You're not going to go back to work the next day. But somebody came up with a technique where they could thread certain tools in through, right, the inferior vena cava from a leg, from a saphenous vein in the leg, get into the atria and close that foramen, and then remove the tools through the vein. And that was a really relatively easy procedure that way. I don't know if people go back to work the next day or not, but they probably could. All right, so ductus, so that is the foramen ovale. All right, but not all blood goes from the right to the left atrium. Some gets into the right ventricle and gets pumped into the pulmonary trunk. Where is the pulmonary trunk going to take blood? Pulmonary artery. Where is the pulmonary artery going to take blood? In us, in anybody. Yeah, lungs, right? But in the fetus, does that blood need to go to the lungs? The answer is no. Right, so blood in this pulmonary trunk has a way to get into the arch of the aorta. There is another tube right here that we call the ductus arteriosus, and it connects the pulmonary artery to the aorta, and that then diverts blood from going to the lungs to get right back into the systemic circulation. Okay, so that, all the structures of the fetal circulation. Right. Well, the first one is the placenta, right here, which is acting like, what is the placenta acting like in the adult? The lungs, and also the liver as well. Okay. And here is a blood vessel bringing blood away from the heart to the placenta. These are the umbilical arteries. Remember, artery takes blood away from the heart. Blood returning from the placenta, this is the umbilical vein. And since the liver is not functional, that it would be a waste of time to have blood going through the and energy going through the liver. So here is that bypass that takes blood directly from the umbilical vein, puts it in the inferior vena cava, and that is the ductus venosus, right? Venosus. And so that's another structure. Another one is the foramen ovale. And then the last one right here is the ductus arteriosus, between the pulmonary artery and the aortic artery. Don't forget the aorta is an artery. And both the foramen ovale and ductus arteriosus divert blood away from the lungs because the fetus isn't breathing at all. All right, so you probably have to know what these different structures turn into in the adult. And in lab, I think you looked at the fossa ovalis, that's a thinning of the interatrial wall. That's where the foramen ovale was at one particular time. What's the placenta in the adult? No such thing, right? As soon as you're born, it goes away. And the umbilical arteries turn into some ligaments, the medial umbilical ligaments. And this umbilical vein turns into the ligamentum teres, which is in the liver. We'll find that later. ligamentum venosum is in the liver as well. And the ductus arteriosus, this we can see in lab very easily, even on the plastic models, it turns into the ligamentum arteriosum. Does anybody remember looking up ligamentum arteriosum if you've done the cardiovascular, if you've done the cardiac lab yet? The Wednesday afternoon group hasn't, right? But you're going to want to find the ligamentum arteriosum. That is just the residual ligament, right? When the ductus arteriosus turned into that ligament, and we're going to find it about right in this area here. Sometimes on some models it's white, sometimes it's yellow. It just all depends. Okay, so when you think of the fetal circulation, model it in your mind as what kind of circulation? And your choice is pulmonary or systemic. Okay? Remember, arteries are taking blood to an organ to pick up oxygen. So it's more like the lungs. It's more like the pulmonary circulation, right? And that's why the umbilical vein is red, because it's high in oxygen, just like the pulmonary veins are high in oxygen. All right, so that's it for lecture today, unless somebody's got a question. Oh, look, here are some portal systems, right? Hepatic portal system we looked at, hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal, and there's one in the nephron as well when we get to the kidney. Okay. All right, let me turn the light on. Sign-in sheet is right here.